In this episode, you're going to learn the surprising benefits of improv. That's right, improv in partnerships and leadership. Why creativity is not a luxury and how the balance of wonder and rigor leads to breakthrough ideas. This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes Sinclair. Welcome to the show.
All right, everyone. We are meeting today with Natalie Nixon, PhD, and we are going to be talking about a bunch of things, but specifically around innovation, creativity, the way in which partnerships and the role of improvisation plays a role in the way that we do business. One of the things, Natalie, that I'm very excited to talk to you about is just how diverse your career has been to date to get you to a place where you're writing multiple books, you're teaching and educating people on this power of creativity, which we all know is really important. I'm not sure we all know how to tap into it. So let's start with the Natalie Nixon backstory, because I think there's some fascinating twists and turns your life and career has taken.
Thank you for that, Phil. And thank you very much for having me. You are correct. I've had a lot of twists and turns in my career, primarily because I've chosen to follow my intuition and my heart, even which meant that often there was not a logical external explanation for why I was deciding to make a shift. But I continue to do that. And that actually, I'll start my origin story, kind of not at the beginning, but in college, I called home upset sophomore year of college, second year of college, because I had a first world problem of needing to declare my major. And my parents had sacrificed a lot for our education. It was a great education, very expensive education. Did not want to disappoint them, want to have a good JOB at the end of those 4 years. Did not know what to major in, and began to apologetically explain to them why I was failing at economics and thought poli-sci was boring and sociology, reduced people to statistics. And they said, okay, now what are you interested in? I kind of talked around it again. They said, what do you want to major in? And I finally admitted, I love this new course I was taking in cultural anthropology. And oh my goodness, these courses in Africana studies are so cool because they're multidisciplinary. And almost at the same time, my parents said, that's what you should study. And I said, wait, what? You would be okay if I studied anthropology and maybe did a double major with Africana studies? And they said, yes. And my father said, Natalie, if you study what you love, you will have to turn down opportunities, because no one will have to tell you to get up earlier, work later, et cetera, stay longer. And it was like this load lifted off my shoulders. And probably much to their chagrin at different parts of my life, I continued to follow that advice of following my heart, but I've never looked back. And so as you referenced, I have a background in cultural anthropology. I've worked in the global fashion industry, but before in the global fashion industry, I was an entrepreneurial hat designer, which again, really came out of need, out of this intuitive nudge. I was living in New York City in my early 20s, couldn't afford to buy any pretty frocks from the boutiques. And I began to sew all my outfits for work because my mom taught us to sew when we were girls. And friends started saying, Nat, I would totally buy that. You should sell that. And I was like, I can't sell this. I just sell this because I can't afford anything. And they said, no, you could sell this. So anyway, that began the journey into launching Nat's Hats, which was never profitable, but it was an incredible entrepreneurial journey, dipping my toe into the fashion industry, into entrepreneurship. And then I ended up working for a division of the Limited Brands, lived abroad in Sri Lanka, Portugal, made bras and panties for the Victoria's Secret brand, traveled a lot throughout Asia. Never been to New Zealand or Australia yet, but hope to be there one day.
Got to make that happen.
Yeah. The fashion industry really taught me a few things. First of all, it is a business. People who've never worked in fashion either think it is frivolous or glamorous, and it's neither. And it taught me the value of trends. It also is an industry, unlike most industries, which understands that consumer behavior is sparked by desire, beauty, aesthetics. And that actually led to a series I used to, and I still do, not as much as I used to though, a series of studios and workshops on how to think like a fashion designer for the tech sector and healthcare sector, right? Because it's a really different lens to understand how to speak in more meaningful ways to the people you're serving. Got tired of being in different time zones and ended up through a series of informational interviews, got an offer to become a professor at Thomas Jefferson University. Ended up being a professor for 16 years. The first 10 years, I taught the business of fashion. In the middle of that, I naively earned a PhD while working full time because I thought, oh, it's just a big paper at the end, naive. I did it. And then the field was design management, and I convinced the university we should be doing something in this space. And they said, great, you do it. I was like, oh, okay. So I became the founding director of the Strategic Design MBA program, which was a phenomenal experience. And in the middle of that, I ended up giving a TEDx Philadelphia talk, basically saying in plain English what my doctoral research was about, which was that the future of work is jazz, and here's why and how. And that actually catapulted me, that talk catapulted me into getting invited to companies and organizations to help them design more improvisational ways of working. And that then led to my husband, John, saying, you're getting so many of these invitations, you have to formalize this. Because I was a happy academic at the time. And I said, oh, okay. So I created Figure Eight Thinking as a side hustle. Woke up a year later and realized I was having more fun with my side hustle. Left academia, have been building Figure Eight Thinking. This will be year 8 at 2025 and have not looked back. And what I do as a creativity strategist is to help people catalyze creativity's ROI so that they can land on more inspired business results. In my perspective, there's not a fuzzy dotted line between creativity and business impact. There's a solid bold line. And creativity is not a nice to have, it's a must have, and it's not something that only artists or designers are great at, but the best attorneys, CFOs, accountants, project managers, plumbers are super creative when they are, as I like to say, toggling between wonder and rigor to solve problems. And that's, and I write, speak around the world, and advise people on how to do that.
Wow. So this is extraordinary for a bunch of reasons. First, I have two daughters, and they are very entrepreneurial. They come from a very entrepreneurial family, and the things that you're talking about resonate strongly with what they're doing right now as a 10 and a 12-year-old. So I can see and feel that happening right now. The idea of studying anthropology, and my mother is an anthropologist by training, we see just how critically important the study of the social sciences, in particular anthropology, is right now to the world. Because, you know, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s even, there was still, I think, quite a disconnect between countries and cultures. The internet turbocharged that. And now, rightly or wrongly, we face into a bunch of really tricky problems because of that wonderful connectivity that, if we got right, would be a lot better for a lot more people. So I think that perspective that you've got through that training and then doubling down the education and then through the work you do, I think is absolutely fascinating. Can we talk a minute about how you see that link between improvisation and creativity? Because as I mentioned in some of our correspondence back and forward, I think that there's a lot more improv that's happening in our lives than we would like to admit to. We like to feel as though we're all together and we're putting out a pretty good persona, but I think most of our minds are pedaling pretty hard to sort of make things happen at any given point in time. So tell me a little bit about that, because that's really struck a chord.
Well, if we're really honest, plans are fiction. And the reason why plans are fiction, whether it's a budget or my own morning daily to-do list, it's fiction because it hasn't happened yet, right? So it's a false sense of security, and it's okay to have the plan. But my urging is that we approach that plan with an adaptive mindset, understanding that there are so many variables and factors that are happening throughout the day. For you, me, your listeners, for most of us, between breakfast and lunch, we've had to hack our way through solving a problem for kids, a spouse, a colleague, a client, right? So we actually are really stellar improvisers. If we look back on our childhoods, we were really great at improvising. It's just that it gets a bit drummed out of us through formal educational cultures of learning that really value having an answer versus falling in love with the process. And the connection and relationship I see between creativity and improvisation, I'll kind of explain from a theoretical perspective, but then also on a really practical level. From a theoretical perspective, all improvisational systems are what we can call chaotic systems, not chaotic systems, but chaotic systems. And a chaord, that's a word that D-Hawk made up. So just like I made up my job title, creativity strategist, he made up this term chaotic. And so D was the first president of Visa, the credit card company. And he was a big naturalist, and he was, you know, given this job to lead. At the time, it was very experimental. It was this global company based on the electronic exchange of financial currency. And he thought to himself, gosh, how could I design this organization in a way that mimicked the way I see nature working? And the way he saw nature working is that there's chaos and there's also order. And chaos is not anarchy. Chaos is randomness. But order is the structure. It's the systems that are in place that kind of always lead to expected, for the most part, conclusions. Like if you're in a forest grove, there's total chaos and randomness in terms of how the branches grow and even the way the leaves look and the variety of that. But the order, if you zoom out a bit, is the beauty of the linearity of the trunks of those trees in that grove, for example. So jazz music is a chaotic, complex system. All improvisational forms are, whether it's comedic improv, theatrical improv, musical improv, dance improv, right? So the connection, so that was actually, I learned that in the process of completing these doctoral studies. My research was actually looking at the ways that the Ritz-Carlton Hotel designs experiences that don't just satisfy guests, but delight them, like have this emotional connection.
Yeah.
How do they do that? And my data showed me that they actually are incredibly improvisational. You can't evoke that emotional experience through a Gantt chart. You need to be able to act in the moment, to respond in the moment, to be observant, to have this mixture of chaos and order. And I use a heuristic from jazz music to explain that. So that was rooted in the way I began to see the world, because I don't know about you, but once I learned about chaotic systems, it was a thing I could not unsee. Like I saw them everywhere. It's the way the human body is designed. It happens in nature. It's the way organizations are organisms. That's that, you know. So I kept seeing it over and over. So no surprise that fast forward when I was, really cultivating my distinctive point of view and value proposition as an entrepreneur, as a creativity strategist, I was tasked with needing to explain in really simple, accessible ways what creativity is, why it's so important for any innovation endeavor. And I landed on, no shocker, and again, it wasn't even deliberate initially, but because that theoretical grounding was all up in my brain cells, I landed on these ideas of wonder and rigor. And so you see the roots of that thinking, right? So wonder is more of the chaos dimension and rigor is more of the order dimension. So creativity is not just doing whatever you feel like. Creativity is not pulling something random out of your armpit. Creativity is not something that only an anointed few are blessed with. To be human is to be hardwired to be creative, and you must commit to designing time and space for that effort. The reason why artists are typically kind of the go-to groups of people in our society who are deemed, the most creative is because they commit to wrangling with the ambiguity of the creative process. They don't shirk away from it. It's so interesting. If you ever go to like an artist open studio or go to a musician set or you know, talk to any artist and you ask them, what are you working on? And a lot of times that they will just like so openly and fresh face say, I don't really know. I don't know where this is going, right? They're so open to the I don't know. And if we're honest with ourselves, even in our corporate environments, most of the time we don't know. We have a plan, which hasn't happened yet, but we really would do well by setting up systems and ways of working that allow for the randomness as well as the structure.
And it's so interesting to me that when an artist would say, and I've heard many friends of mine who are in those fields say, I really don't know where this is going. And there is this level of confidence in that statement, which frightens many others, right? I don't know where this is going. You say that to a market in an earnings call and bad things happen almost immediately on the statement, right? There is this capacity though. And there is a particular leader here in Australia is very well known. I won't mention his name. And he consults, he's almost a consigliere to many of Australia's most senior and internationally senior leaders. And he is renowned for saying, I don't know.
I love that.
And for the people that are on the receiving end of that, hoping that he's got a magical answer or at least some insight to help drive them to a particular place, it is super confronting, but in some cases also relieving to know that, well, I don't have any more information than you do. I don't know. And if you don't know, that's probably fine. Let's keep working through it. And I wonder how we introduce this to more people, because there is so many more unknowns. And to your point around the order versus the chaos, and that distinction I think is really important about not being anarchy. It is the way systems work, right? And this is something that people really need to wrap their minds around. So let's talk a little bit about The Creativity Leap. This is your second book. There is a third one coming, as you just described, later this year, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in the year. When you introduce the idea of that leap for people, tell me a little bit about how, for people who are a little bit more rigid, let's say, for example, and no disrespect to people that come from very traditional professions who are taught a particular way, and we could be talking about folks who are in accounting or in law or in professions which are very, very deliberately systematized. How do you introduce this idea of taking a creative leap and the tools you've just talked about? Because in most cases, people who are attracted to those professions are attracted because there is a perceived order to that profession.
Yeah. Well, I always try to start with some humor. So even when I land that observation that the plans are fiction, you know, it can evoke some chuckles and people realize, okay, that's true if you put it that way. You know, the budget is a plan, but you know, we're always tweaking it. So I start with having us kind of really examine the present state and unpack it and really be honest about, is that actually how we tend to proceed in our work? Right. And if honestly the answer is, well, no, not really, then we kind of open up the door to have a conversation about, well, what actually is happening? So when I started introducing into corporate C-suite environments this idea of wonder, first of all, I was terrified to utter those words in the hallowed halls of corporate America, because I thought I would be laughed out of the room. So what I would tend to do is, you know, after a session or meeting, talking, and I would kind of casually just start bringing up this new project and framework that I've been introducing to other clients. That's totally like spitballing right then. This idea of wonder and rigor, I'm always prototyping ideas through conversation, through my keynotes as well, and I would notice their body language. They would soften, they would kind of lean in. And they would say, what do you mean by that? And so I knew I was on to something just by the fact that they were curious to understand and learn more. There was this thirst to humanize the work and for me to help dispel that wonder is not woo-woo. So for example, Socrates famously said that wonder is the root of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And then centuries later, there's a Jewish American, he was a theologist and a civil rights activist, Abraham Heschel. He wrote that it's wonder, not doubt, which is the root of all knowledge. So if you want to be more wise, more knowledgeable, you actually need to spend some time engaged in wonder, which is about audacity and curiosity and awe and pausing. So that's one part, is that I introduce it with humor. I start with our present state, and I kind of just dispel some myths that we have about the way we actually work and give some gravitas to this reality that it actually is part of the human condition to wonder. Hmm. The other piece is that I'm married to a lawyer. One reason I was attracted to him is he's the yin to my yang. He's a planner. I'm not. I'm really good at big picture, and he's really good at the details. Then I have a former colleague who's an accountant, who's also a storm chaser. We collaborated together and wrote, it's like a Q&A conversation about how financial services could benefit from wonder and rigor. So what I observe in John, my husband's work as an attorney, and what over the years, what he has slowly but surely accepted, is that he's incredibly creative in the ways that he does work for his clients. Mm-hmm. Because the rigor is he knows the law. He and the client have this intended goal and outcome. But the wonder and the creative problem solving process is how he can circle an issue from all these different angles and identify potential future scenarios. If this, then that. That is a creative act. Yep. That you can't get to if you don't have emotional intelligence, if you don't factor in the variables of the environment, the economic environment, the cultural environment, the zeitgeist of the time, right? So I have close to me evidence of how these industries that are highly regulated for good reason, actually, there's so many data points of when creative problem solving is really essential and really necessary. And my work with Jim Caruso, who was the colleague who I co-authored this article with about not creative accounting, which is bad, but creativity in the accounting process. So for example, a balance sheet is telling a story. It's a snapshot in time about the ways resources were used. If we know, we can, just like statistical data, we can shift the story. We can decide to emphasize X over Z and all that sort of thing to understand how we want to relay information, right? So those are just various ways that I begin to level set and spark in people that creative confidence that they actually are incredibly creative.
You know, it's funny, and I think you've just touched on the power of a great educator. So some of the language you've just used takes me back to business school, where we had some outstanding teachers that created a new narrative around some very dry, at least for me, dry topics that then sort of inspired a very different way of looking at these different topics. I wonder if we take a step from that into curiosity and then into business partnership. And when we talk about partnerships, we're talking about the way in which two companies need to talk to each other, in fact, to just be curious of what each other does, because there's an instinct there somewhere that maybe we could be better together, not necessarily to merge, but just to do work together to make things better. And I'm, you know, when we think about the wonder and rigor, I think that language is remarkably apt for the early formations of two people coming together over coffee or at a bar somewhere saying, listen, I've heard that you're working on this. I'm happy to put a little bit of my political capital on the line to let you know a little bit about what we're doing off the record, because I feel as though we could, you, if we did it with you, we could be doing something a lot better than us just trying to go it alone. Tell me a bit about how you would frame that for people, given how many parts of the factors you've just talked about play a role in that early formation of a relationship.
Well, you just set the table, no pun intended, you're talking about meeting at a coffee shop, but you set the table really well for the role and value of inquiry and curiosity. Even to approach someone, to have a coffee, to get together, to explore an unknown is an example of of tiptoeing into liminal space, of tiptoeing into ambiguous space, of the not knowing, which by the way, liminal space is where we get to be at the precipice of discovery. If you think about any great new thing that or experience has happened in your life, personally or professionally, for most of us, it happened not out of this grand certainty, but out of these moments of not really knowing and wondering, what if, you know, how might we? So starting with curiosity is actually one of the, I'm a nerd. I love frameworks. There's a reason why my business is called Figure Eight Thinking. Yep. I love to think. And I also, it's called Figure Eight Thinking because when we shift our mental models, that begins to shift behaviors, which then shifts culture. But mm-hmm. it starts with the way you think about stuff. So I knew it was not going to be enough for me to say, okay, toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems. Off you go. You'll be creative. Like, that's not really helpful. Like, how do you do that on a consistent, sustainable basis? And that's when I came up with this tool, this framework called the three I's. Now, the three I's are inquiry, improvisation, and intuition. So inquiry is such a fundamental tool and scaffolding for creativity. Knowing how to ask questions, being brave to ask questions is really essential because questions are inputs into a system. And that system could be a new business model. That system could be making lunch. But the more diverse the inputs or the questions, the more innovative the output. So being able to have this query that you know you won't get resolved until you can't stay in your head, but you got to like talk it out. Just wonder how another person might think about it is so essential for progressing and moving the needle. Because I, by myself, or even just with you, Phil, we can't think of the infinite number of possible outcomes for a process than we could if there were like four other people who joined us or nine other people, et cetera. So that curiosity is really important. The challenge is that a lot of us have been question shamed either early on in an educational experience or early on the job, got your hand slapped or got giggles, or even worse, you were ignored if you asked a question. So you learn very quickly, oh, we don't ask questions around here. But again, questions are inputs into a system. I love the work of Warren Berger, A More Beautiful Question. And he talks about how asking questions is a way of thinking.
Yes, exactly. Right?
Yep. Knowing how to frame questions. So that is essential for partnership because it also shows vulnerability when we can ask a question. And partnership needs that vulnerability to know that I'm only as good as us together, and I don't have all the answers. And I want to work with you because of the way this can be super complementary.
When you think about the partnerships you've observed or the ones you've been part of, as you as an individual, what are you looking for as the key ingredients to go, actually, there's a there, as opposed to, I might let this one sort of pass by. What are those sort of things that you're in, the human factors that you're going, actually, no, I think we should take this to the next level?
It actually is those three I's. It's working with people who are curious, who ask me questions that I've never considered before, who are open to questions. It's people who are willing to be experimental to an extent and who are willing to tinker with an idea, with a process. And it's also, I mean, early on in our conversation, I shared the advice I got from my parents, which I took to be, you know, follow your heart, you know, be intuitive. I value people who listen to that nudge and then who express it. It's a level of self-inquiry that can really take a project miles. So those qualities are really important. And you know, I'll give an example of when I was an academic and I was tasked with launching this strategic design MBA program, there weren't any, I mean, there might have been a few programs that were similar in Europe, but we had no real proof of concept. We were a proof of concept, and we approached it as this experiment. Our goal was to try to figure out how might we create a graduate learning experience for future business leaders that would be a mashup of the best of business school meets the best of design school. Didn't really see a lot of it. Like Aalto University in Helsinki does some great things. Some places and some of the Nordic countries have, in Germany and Netherlands as well. But that required me. So first of all, the way I built the faculty, I wanted to have faculty that were both practitioners in industry and people who were scholars in traditional academics. I knew that this was a program that would not benefit from either or type of mentality. Actually, the moniker of the program was the MBA for hybrid thinkers, right? So that's an example of work that I've done where I proactively sought out people who were willing to be part of an interesting experiment. It could totally flop and fail. Don't know what's going to happen, but it was really exciting because we discerned that the market needed new ways of thinking. And this is before AI, you know, took off, which is a whole nother part of our conversation about how that's impacting the way we think about creativity, about partnership. But, you know, working with people who are innately curious, open to being experimental, and to the intuitive is really important to me.
Let's do some improv here right now. You've just touched on something which is very important for us today and will be for the next number of years around this combination of AI creativity and partnership, although it's maybe a little bit less. When we have the chance to tap in a set of sentences into a command line on ChatGPT for it to help us respond or to form an idea, is there a risk once you learn how that works and how you start to become proficient at that, is there a risk that that ends up not helping our creativity in the long term, where we become less curious because the answers are so readily, or a set of answers, maybe not the correct set of answers, are put to us so quickly?
Yes, that certainly is a risk. I don't have a dystopian view of this technology. I don't have a utopian view. I have what my friend Galit Ariel calls a heterotopian view. I have a healthy level of constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. And I love the ways that this technology can help us to arrive at answers more quickly.
Yes.
So that we can then collaborate more, so that we can noodle on it a bit even more expansively. If we just take something like ChatGPT or Claude or Notebook LM, these are technologies are only as good as the questions that we are able to ask.
Yes.
So for me, it stretches me to what's different way I could ask this question? Maybe I could flip it, to see what would be the outcome there. Now, of course, that's very self-directed. And are there challenges with younger people? If this is like the first tool that they're getting access to, that it could truncate their learning, the growth? It could, but for my next book, which is called Move, Think, Rest, Redefining Productivity and Our Relationship with Time, I interviewed over 50 people from a range of sectors and backgrounds. One of the people is a cognitive scientist from Vassar College who developed a dialogical AI tool. In other words, it wasn't just about the person asking questions to the machine, to the algorithm, but the algorithm would ask questions back to the student, in this case, to the person. Mm-hmm. So it helps with metacognition, helps with self-reflexivity. It helps with introverted people who may be a bit shy to really forge and explore an idea in an open classroom environment, but just with the laptop, they will go at it and they'll be having this conversation that's really pushing them. Why do you think that? What else, what are some other alternative ways to be thinking about this, right? So that those dialogical ways that AI is being developed are really interesting. And by the way, that's Dr. Josh Liu of Vassar College who developed that. But there's others that have evolved since then. So yes, I think there is a risk. I think that these technologies require us to be very intentional about how we use them. And we have so many examples from the past of how our fears that new technology would eradicate the way we have become used to doing things, which is true, but it's not all bad news. For example, like when the phonograph was introduced, I'm sure there was a group of people who thought, oh my gosh, no one's going to ever go to live music anymore. Right? That didn't happen. It's a different experience, right? Example I use in the Creativity Leap, I am of the hip hop generation, mm-hmm. and I marvel at the fact that at a time in truncated public spending of the arts and public schools in the United States in the 70s and late 70s, early 80s, there were young African-American men in a lot of urban areas throughout the United States who turned a technology like the turntable into an instrument. Mm-hmm. They said, actually, this is kind of cool. This could be a new kind of percussive instrument, right? Now, yeah. Hip-hop music is the largest genre of music in the world, right? So there are an infinite number of possibilities and ways we could do mashups and recombinations of things as new technology gets introduced. And we have to have a healthy dose of critique and consciousness about these technologies as well.
Very well said. And I think the aspect here that you've touched on, which is pointed, I think, to any parent who has got children going through school where they have very early exposure in their learning journeys as a human to tools like this, is that when the model is right, and it can ask those kind of questions, it actually does a much better job than parents probably could of probing and asking questions to help their child communicate more effectively the things that they're trying to get out of their young minds. And this is something that we've explored and understood with our girls, obviously very young. But even for us as adults and as advisors, as coaches, there is usually a playbook of questions that we have which we've tended to rely on. And they've been quite effective in many parts, but we need to have a greater set of questions that we can ask as well that can help people broaden their horizons. Natalie, I'm wondering, you know, when you look at, we've talked about some of the partnerships in the MBA program that you helped to establish. When you think about a really positive partnership you've been part of, I'd love to sort of walk through that in some detail so that we could understand, you know, what was the nuts and bolts? Because when we look at partnerships for people, often you hear about one of two outcomes. It was great and it changed an industry, or it started and it died. And the majority of the stories actually in that latter camp, not in the former camp. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you could help us walk through a partnership that you've been part of or you've observed that we could sort of tear down a little bit to sort of understand why it was so effective, and you know, the extent to which the framework that you've got played a role in that observation. Have you got one that we could talk to?
Yeah, I would actually go back to that example because I think it's in certain respects it failed, and in other respects it was a great success. So starting with the positive, and this kind of gets to the determinants of what to look out for great partnerships. It was successful in the impact it had on these graduate students' lives. It changed their lives and the ways that they thought about themselves, their career trajectories, how they showed up in their own organizations, on their own teams. Because this program was designed for graduate students who were working full-time while they were in school, which, by the way, those are my favorite types of students because they want to understand yesterday how the theory applies to practice.
Yes.
So great partnerships, when they're successful, are able to, I think, not try to be everything to everybody and understand that probably what's yielded, it could be really specific, but what is seeded can be exponential, right? In the case of how these graduate students, who I still stay in touch with in various ways, are doing work and have gone on to do great work. the challenge was the bucket in which the partnership might happen. So I am a recovered academic, and higher education, God bless it, is not the most innovative space. It's correct. Highly bureaucratic.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I was in a faculty meeting and there was an announcement of the committee on the committee. And I thought, wait, what? Did someone just say that? Gosh, right? So that's the reality. And so we did this experiment within the confines, within the construct of an institution that had a lot of constraints on budget, on regulatory things, on I'm in the city of Philadelphia, which is what we call an eds and meds city, lots of higher ed, lots of medical and pharma. And, you know, we were in the shadows of Wharton, one of the most established, well-known business schools
programs in the world. Yeah.
That has a very traditional way of doing things. So, you know, partnerships have to think about context, is the short of what I'm trying to say. Partnerships have to think about context, timing, but also not being afraid to be original and to be have a really distinctive point of view, to not be copy paste, definitely don't be cut paste, but to really identify what is our unique way of contributing to this established way of doing things. Hmm. Those are some of the insights I take from that.
I find that some of the most effective partnerships are remembered by the people that they impacted the most. So you talked about the students whose lives were changed. How do you think, say, in 5 or 10 years' time, those students who went through that program would describe that event to others? Maybe not to you, but to others. What sort of language do you think they'd use to describe that?
I think they would describe it as life-changing. Mm-hmm. I think they would describe it as not these words right, but like it gave them a new set of glasses to put on, like a new lens. So often change does not happen with a 180 degree shift. Most change happens with like a fissure in the system. It's a 9 degree shift. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you see, just by shifting your thinking in this angle, it's like a whole new world opens to you. So they now have tools and a way of thinking. Again, they shifted their mental model, which shifted their behaviors and can impact the way they impact culture and their organizations in ways that are just phenomenal. So in the world of design thinking and human-centered innovation, there's so many cool frameworks. One of my favorites is this idea that the most innovative products, services, or experiences are solving a problem on a functional, social, and emotional level.
Nice.
When you think about products, services, experiences, it's like, yeah, you know, the trains are running on time. When you push the button, it turns on. It's solving it on a functional level.
Yeah.
Functional and social level, when you push the power button, it turns on. And maybe you have interconnectivity with loved ones or with people you care about or helping to build community. But the products and services and experiences that have an impact on a functional, social, and emotional level, because they're affecting self-esteem, they're affecting confidence, they're affecting worldview. Those are the most innovative ones. And it's actually entrepreneurs need to double down on the emotional problem that they're solving. It's kind of easy to solve stuff on the functional and social, but that emotional need, have you identified the emotional need? And so those examples I just gave of what I'm hoping graduates of that program are walking away with, what I spoke to was that on that emotional level of how it wasn't just an MBA. It was an MBA that helped them just to think differently, which no one can take away from you.
I get that. And it's funny when you talk about those different types of product developments or experience developments, the only consistent measure that I've been able to find where you've achieved all three of those is when someone goes, huh, that's cool. because they don't actually we don't have any more language than that because we're so stunned at how well it all interconnects. So yeah, super interesting. Natalie, we're going to link to all of the things in the show notes, but where can people visit you to learn more about you and the work and Figure Eight?
They should go to figure8thinking.com. That's the number 8. And definitely sign up for the Ever Wonder newsletter. It's a free newsletter. Lots of great information and tools. And we're launching a premium version that has downloads and worksheets and templates. And also connect with me. Follow me on LinkedIn and on Instagram. LinkedIn, it will be obvious. Instagram, it's Nat W. Nixon.
Awesome. We will send people all the way there. This has been such a fun conversation. And Natalie, I've got two more questions for you. In fact, I have some rapid fire questions for you, but I do have one other question for you before we get there. And this is more about today. And I'd be interested to see what happens if we were to revisit this conversation maybe in 5 years' time. Mm. What do you think leaders are missing today when it comes to the power of partnership and doing things together?
I think that they're missing the role of kind of going back to what we said, the role of I don't know, the role of humility, of the whole point of the partnership is to be hopefully complementary and to lean into each other. Hmm. So I think that in a world where we are so fixated on having the answers and having more tools to give us the answer, an ability to embrace that ambiguity, that I don't know, and this actually counterintuitively makes the partnership a lot stronger.
Yeah, I agree. I do wonder how much more partnership is going to happen because of the constraint. And I think it's going to be a lot more because I think a lot of people have worked out actually be really good at the thing you're really good at and then find other people and other organizations that can complement you on that.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. So listen, 5 questions rapid fire. We ask these of every guest, and I'll let you know what is consistent with your answers compared to other people, because it's often a pretty fun ride. So are you ready to go?
Yes.
All right. Question number 1, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Best when improvised.
What content are you loving at the moment? And it can be anything.
Any podcast that the Financial Times puts out. Also Slow News Podcast, which is a British investigative journalism podcast. But the Financial Times has this really great series called Working It, which mm-hmm. is all about redesigning work. But I think it's just very beautifully, intentionally designed journalism.
They do a great job. They do a fantastic job. Question 3, what is the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
When I was an academic, a young assistant professor thinking about doing a PhD, I went to a leader in the university who was also a woman, asked for advice, and the person told me, "I don't think you should work on your PhD. You're fine the way you are. You have your master's degree." At the time, that was in academia, it's the terminal degree in your field. And I walked away thinking, "Really? But she has a PhD. Why wouldn't she think I should get a PhD?" And luckily, I ignored that advice. I decided to pursue it anyway.
That's amazing. And I do love how earlier in our conversation, you just made the quib that you just accidentally acquired a PhD. I don't see how that could be a small thing to do, but congratulations, because it's the right decision to make. All right. So when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Ask, can we meet? Ask for a coffee. I ask a question.
Just so you know, that is the 90% answer of people on this show.
Okay.
Well, it's I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to socialize with you. I'm going to get to know you on a human level before we do anything else. I mean, no surprises really to that, but the number of people who go, "I find that really interesting. I feel I want people to do a lot more of that just to get to know
each other." I go back to Amanda Palmer's book, The Art of Asking. John, my husband, his advice, don't ask, don't get. You got to ask.
Got to ask. That's it. Final question. What's the one thing you're most grateful for right now?
My team. As an entrepreneur, it took, it allows me for myself. It took me a minute to, I had a lot of failures, a lot of experiments, we should say, and I'm really great. It's a small team, and it's a team that I feel really good about. Two incredible women, Tracy, my COO, Jesse, my VA, and they're just incredibly smart, responsive, compassionate, curious about my work, which is super helpful.
Yep.
So we'll see where we go.
A great team makes a huge difference. Natalie Nixon, thank you so much for making the time today. We will talk again before your next book comes out, and I'm excited for that and the journey. So thanks for making the time.
Thank you so much for this invitation, Phil. Great to talk with you.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.